I'm ready whenever you are.
Okay.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me as always, Brian Rees.
That's me. I'm here. Thank you, Paul.
There. No, I'm here. You're there.
Well, no, I'm here and you're there.
I don't understand how that works.
I don't. It's very confusing. It's a system of, it's because they're tubes and wires.
I think that's fake news.
Yeah, and so we're both here and there at the same time.
Oh, it's kind of like a wave and a particle.
Particle Man is my favorite superhero.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Does sound like a golden age hero of some
sort. It does. Yeah.
Well, enough of this jolly banter.
Wherever you go, there you are.
Today on the program, we'll be talking about Black Panther by Christopher Priest, The Complete Collection, Volume 1. Covering Marvel Knights Black Panthers, issues 1 to 17. But before we get into that, we are going to randomly talk about stuff. We haven't actually chosen any topics for today.
We have no topics today. There's nothing happening.
Yeah. Did you say it earlier? We're topicless? We're going topicless? But
Someone do something stupid so we could talk about it, please?
Yes. I mean, there were some stupid things that we've kind of missed our window of opportunity on, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we wanted to talk about Bill Maher, but it's at this point, why?
Exactly. I think it's best just to ignore him and move on. I had tweeted when that happened something along the lines of, it's bad when a moron thinks he's smart, but it's worse when a moron thinks he's smart and tries to educate people on what they should and shouldn't like. I think I was a little bit more eloquent with that. But the idea is there.
Yes, it's. I think we call that mansplaining. Is that what the kids are?
Well, it's called being a dick. For something we're not going to talk about, we're actually talking about.
We're suddenly talking about. Well, we can. Most people listening here can guess like our take on the matter, and probably share similar views. So. Yeah. The most attention we're going to give him is to, as you just said, basically say he's a dick.
Yeah. But as a general feeling about this whole thing, I'm really kind of annoyed by the Bill Maher's on one side who just want to crap on everything and say you guys are stupid for doing that. But then on the other side, there's the gatekeepers who you're only supposed to like certain things within comics,
right?
Can't we just like what we like? And
well, and maybe that's therein is the issue. It's there's so much trying to think of how to like put this correctly. Everybody wants a piece of the knowledge of comics, and everybody, there's a reason like that comic book culture has been sort of traditionally derided or stereotyped for a long period of time. And it's where like the people like Bill Maher and many other folks out there who still say things like, oh, comics are just for kids or comics aren't serious literature. And some of that is fandom's fault. And some of that is the fault of those outside looking in who have never bothered to actually investigate sort of the culture of comics outside of, comic book guy in The Simpsons.
Right. Well, I mean, there was a time 50 years ago that was the case. Like in the 1950s and early 60s, yeah, they were for kids because the comic books code crushed any real creativity that was going on and stifled a lot of the writers and a lot of the artists. But right. That's changed dramatically in the last couple of decades.
For the good.
Yes, for the good.
Of course. But even at the time, even if there was no comics code, I'm not sure that comics would have even aimed at the sophistication that some of them have now, only because they really were being made for kids and reductively for, sort of working class blue collar folks who, would spend their 5 cents or 10 cents or whatever at the newsstand and buy, some form of escapism.
Yeah,
but in the same way they were buying pulp novels.
Right, but over the history of comics, during wartime, the soldiers read comics. It was like a it was like a safety blanket for them. Yeah. And then in the 60s, you had the college kids into all the psychedelia and so forth. And underground comics became this huge thing. Right. All that evolved in the 70s.
Marvel definitely played on that.
Yeah, absolutely. DC did to a certain extent as well.
But Marvel really, you would see Stan's soapboxes where he would talk about, a lot of them would deal with him talking about, I'm going to talk to, college classes and this and the other. And, they really build up this idea of Marvel as a more intellectual pursuit than comics had been viewed as before that. Now you read some of those comics and you realize that the hyperbole may have been, hyperbole.
Yeah. Well, it was Stan Lee being Stan Lee. That's fine because it was actually promoting something, getting more of an audience and allowing the medium to experiment more.
Right.
So that in the 70s, it expanded and became something completely different. And then in the 80s, we all know what happened in the 80s. I mean, boy, it really took off and created very modern, mature, storytelling and themes. The 90s, as extreme as it was, boy, there was a lot of experimentation going on.
Yes.
It's an evolving medium. That's kind of what art does.
Exactly. And the thing is, I still get IDW's Star Trek. There are various Star Trek series. I still pick up Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck and DuckTales, along with my serious important comics. And I pick those up because they entertain me in the same way that I will read James Joyce's Ulysses and then I will read a hard-boiled crime novel from Hard Case Crime or something in the next sentence, I'll rotate between those. It's like comics can just be for entertainment and that's okay. And I think we run into a lot of problems with the over-intellectualizing of comics as well, where a lot of the men in tights type comics are poo-pooed and still viewed as a lesser component while building up, some of the more independent creators and the more navel-gazing type comics. And those are very good. I'm not, I reserve the right to be able to read both. But you still get, in the sort of pro-comics intelligentsia, the sort of downward-looking view of the tights type comics, the superhero comics.
Well, it's the same thing with, literature. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of, literary novels, but at the same time, I read YA novels and fantasy as well. And that's always looked down upon, but it's just as good as the other stuff. And movies, I can watch Moonlight and still watch Infinity War. And they're equally as good to me,
And it's the idea that one supersedes the other in terms of importance, whereas I think they both are dependent upon each other for their survival in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you see that. That's one of the things I've always... So listeners might know, Brian and I both used... Brian still works at a bookstore. I used to work at a bookstore as well. And there's all the differentiation, the classifications of all the different genres. But the one that always annoyed me was literary fiction. As if it was some kind of... It was somehow greater than all the other genres out there.
I can't stand that designation. I'm with you. It's always driven me crazy. And there was that great article in The Atlantic 20 plus years ago where they took to task some of the so-called literary writers and basically pointed out that, people like E.N.E. Prue and Don DeLillo and Cormac, the sainted Cormac McCarthy really didn't write books so much as sentences.
Oh, Cormac McCarthy's sentences are pretty good, but that's beside
the point. But are they writing stories? Well, yes. We're not here to. Sorry.
Yeah.
This isn't
Cormac McCarthy podcast.
Yeah.
No, but I'm a very big fan of fantasy. Just one of the reasons I love comic books.
Right.
But the genre of fantasy is the, no offense, Brian, the redheaded stepchild of fiction. I'm sorry.
Whatever do you mean by no offense?
Well, you being a redheaded stepchild. But it just bothers me so much.
Folks in this podcast are learning way more about me than they ever have before.
Well, it's good. It's good to share every once in a while.
Yeah.
No, but the idea that fantasy is somehow lesser, and I always like to point out, you know, the Iliad. Yeah, that's fantasy. But anyway, the whole point of this is, comic books are an art form, and there's different levels of reading it. I mean, there's your Donald Ducks, and at the same time, there's like Persepolis, which is like high art. Anyway,
right. Or mouse.
Exactly. These are, you know, and everything in between, but
there's a lot of really good current stuff. I don't, you know, we're both, well, Persepolis is relatively recent, but you know, there's very good independent and very good semi-autobiographical comics coming out now through smaller presses and whatnot that are quite good as well. We don't cover those in the same way we cover, I think, the more pop culture aspects of comics. I mean, you know, we did Love and Rockets, you know, I mean, there's so much out there, and it's such a wealth of style and genre and skill level.
And various types of storytelling and various types of, it's an incredibly malleable and beautiful medium, a beautiful art form. Yeah. And, you know, just to dismiss it as it's just for kids is ridiculous. It's moronic.
But at the same time, it's okay when they are just for kids.
Well, yeah.
And that's the other problem, is saying something's just for kids, I'm like, what's the problem there as well? Yeah, it's like you were saying, you know, it's like you read young adult novels, right, and people are like, it's just for kids. And it's like, well, ostensibly, yes. And you know what? Sometimes, like, if you look at kids' picture books, I deal with, you know, I see kids' picture books. There's some amazing, great stuff in there. And, you know, we would say, well, that's just for kids. Those are picture books, whatever. And then I'm like sitting here going, but I'll read these. It may take me 5 minutes to read them. It won't be a big investment of my time, but they're great. And so, again, it's like the sort of just for kids, even if something is just for kids, shouldn't negate its importance or the fact that it's interesting.
Exactly. You judge something by what it is and not what you want it to be.
Right.
Or what you think it should be. And once you do that, you'll find something inherently good and something beneficial in it. So
the bottom line is, or it'll make you laugh or make you smile without, you know, any other message other than to make you laugh or make you smile. That to me seems like a perfectly great thing to want to do for people.
Yes, I agree. All right, so I think we got a good 5-10 minutes out of not wanting to talk about that.
Well, the best part is we talked about it without having to address the actual.
We didn't have to mar the conversation.
Oh.
By mentioning his name. On that note,
I think that joke was very marginal.
So I think on that note, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some Black Panther.
Sounds good.
All right.
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you, too,
can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back. Paul, today is your recommendation. What are you going to have us read and talk about today, Paul?
We are going to talk about Black Panther by Christopher Priest, The Complete Collection, Volume 1. It covers Marvel Knights Black Panther issues 1 to 17. And it goes a little something like this. Black Panther was created in 1966 by Jack Kirby with an assist from Stan Lee. Originally a Fantastic Four antagonist and later ally, he became so popular he began appearing in other titles, eventually becoming an Avenger, and starring in his own standalone titles, with a notable run by Don McGregor and Billy Graham. No, not that Billy Graham.
Ow!
Despite this early popularity, Black Panther's titles were short-lived, and he would only appear sporadically over the next couple of decades. That is until 1998, when Christopher Priest reintroduced the hero as part of the slightly more adult Marvel Knights line in this critically acclaimed series that ran until 2003. The stories we'll be discussing today are half political thriller, half urban crime adventure, and half outright comedy. I know that's a lot of halves, but there's a lot going on here. Together with art by Mark Teixeira and Vince Evans, Priest reinvented Black Panther. He gave the character an edge and added political and social satire to his story while deftly weaving decades of old storylines flawlessly into the narrative. It makes T'Challa a fully rounded and complex character, torn between his obligations as head of state, a defender of the people, a team member, and a friend. The run changed the way we think of Black Panther. It added political intrigue to the already established Afrofuturism of Wakanda. It changed the way his supporting characters were portrayed and perceived, and he added new elements like the Dora Milaje that have become staples of the series ever since. The Black Panther was always cool. Christopher Priest made him remarkable and revolutionary. Brian, what did you think of this run of Black Panther?
It was weird.
Wasn't it?
And I don't mean that as a pejorative. So there was the narrative structure, I have to admit, right off the bat, was a tad frustrating.
Really? Okay.
In the sort of, it basically jumped all over the place. And you had to get the full narrative, you had to get several issues in for each sort of narrative, for each sort of narrative bit, which was an interesting experiment, but I'm not 100% sure it worked 100% of the time.
I could see that. I enjoyed that because I enjoyed the structure. Okay, so we should say it's told in flashbacks from the point of view of Everett Ross, who's a government agent.
And the comic relief.
And the comic relief. So it's told through his perspective, and we're getting his kind of handling of Black Panther while he's in the States, and all these things are going on. And so you're right, it does jump around quite a bit. But at the same time, I liked getting a couple issues in, and then like a punchline will drop, and you'll go, oh, that's from issue 3. And I would always flip back and see. I enjoyed that, actually.
Right.
It proves that Christopher Priest had this planned out well.
He did, right. But it's also, it becomes tricky because it suggests, particularly in that era when this was really starting out, there was a lot of what we would call writing for the trade.
Yes. I think 98 is when that really started becoming a thing.
Yeah. And you see in these issues what I would consider writing for the trade, because like you said, something would drop on issue 4 and you would be like, oh, I vaguely remember that from issue 1, but I remember that from issue 1 because I'm reading this in a trade, so I just read this 30 right. minutes ago as opposed to 4 months ago.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so in a monthly serialized format, it might get really, I could see how that would be frustrating. I originally read this in a trade.
So. Right, and I was reading it as a trade as well for this. Yeah. So I did not read this during its original run.
Neither did I. I didn't read this until well into the 2000s.
And I think the only the only Marvel Knights series I think I read at the ongoing at the time, of course, was Daredevil.
Yeah, I don't think I read a Marvel Knights series as it was coming out. I've read everything in trade later.
Right.
You know, and Marvel Knights was hit or miss. There were some good, like the Punisher run was right. Good.
Oh, I think it was a very interesting concept.
It was a good experiment, and it did yield some good results. It also yielded some questionable results as well.
Sure, but I think it also opened up the way to open up the path to like say Max, the truly adult imprint that Marvel eventually
went a little crazy. But hey, let's talk about Black Panther.
Okay.
Now you gotta love a story. Would you say it's a little weird? It starts out in the very first issue dealing with a deal with the devil, and that's what I knew that this series. I remember reading it the first time and went, "Really? Wow! You're gonna have Mephisto, like in the first couple of pages, just sitting there with Ross,
which is great. Oh, those are great scenes.
They really are. Yeah.
It is worth it's worth the cost of the trade alone for the Everett K. Ross and Mephisto scenes.
Yes.
And it's also, you might notice that those scenes are very Bendis-like.
Yeah, well, are you saying that Bendis copied Priest, or?
I don't know. Or did he copy Jim Owsley?
Oh, chicken egg. Which came first, the Owsley or the Priest? But no, I mean,
do we even clarify that or just assume, well?
No, you know, look it up, folks. Yeah. No, I love, this is 98. So, you know, the decompressed storytelling was not as prevalent as it is today. It was starting to be.
Right. And to be clear, these the majority of these comics are not decompressed. There's
a lot going on here.
There's a poop ton of action
going
on and a lot happening, but these scenes with Mephisto and Ross and the fact that Ross has no pants.
And it's beautiful. They're just sitting there waiting for something to happen.
Right. They're waiting for the Black Panther to show up, and they're in his apartment, and the Black Panther is out fighting crime, and Mephisto just shows up, and the Black Panther's handler, Everett Ross, opens the door and lets him in. And what proceeds is random pages of just Mephisto and a pantsless Ross just sitting next to each other. Having great conversation.
Yes, they're having awkward conversation. If you've ever been in a room with someone you don't want to be with and trying to make small talk, just picture if that's someone you don't want to be with is the devil. Now, that was extremely well done.
And I think Mephisto was always like a kind of a fun character to insert into comics. I up until, say, One More Day, after which I think Mephisto has lost his luster a little bit.
That aside, I first of all, the reason I really like these stories, I like the Everett Ross framing device. It allows some of the more complicated and political, social, racial ideas to stand alone. You don't have to explain, you know, they don't have to be explained because Ross is experiencing it for the first time. So we get to see it through his eyes. And Christopher Priest actually said that he used that framing device because he knew that Marvel readership was primarily white, and he wanted a way in, basically, to write about what he wanted to write about.
And I think that was very interesting that Priest made sure to comment upon that, because I think one of the knocks without Priest going in and explaining his thought process, and I read that in one of the way I read it, I have the actual letters pages and things like that, so... Right. I got to see kind of the evolving discussion about representation in Black Panther. And one of my initial concerns was you are taking, a story which is primarily based on Africans and literally Africans, and also just, and not just Africans, but then also the African-American experience comes into play as well later on in a really great arc within this larger arc. But, yeah. You know, one of my initial concerns had been, you know, we're seeing this via the sort of the white guy's voice. And it's the white guy's voice telling the story of the Black Panther. And I initially was kind of like, what's Christopher Priest doing here? And then reading further and him explaining why he did it without, you know, me having to get him, call him up on the phone and ask.
Right.
I think kind of calmed me down a little bit in terms of why it was Ross's point of view that was representative of the telling of the story.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I understand that, but I like the way that, well, I think he did it very cleverly in the fact that Ross, he's the fact that he's so bumbling and clueless eases us in, and he's so clueless. And then the reason he has to have people explain things to him is because he really doesn't know what's going on at any given moment. And it's a nice way to have, you know, have him as the comic relief and an entry point into getting some pretty deep concepts, not spoon fed, but explained in a certain way to people who might not be familiar with these concepts.
Right.
Not just racial and social issues, but also what's life like in Wakanda? What are the politics? What's, you know, who is the Black Panther? All of those things are explained to us through Ross. You know, so if someone's doesn't really know the Black Panther all that well, you're introduced in a nice, funny way, I thought.
Right.
But like I said, some of the themes that he's working with here are pretty heavy, even if there is a little comic element to it. For instance, politics.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I was going to say the political intrigue of Wakanda, the way Priest handles it is fascinating to me.
Oh yes. I think that's one of the more exemplary and interesting points to the whole 17 issues and whatnot is, I mean, this is deep political intrigue. I mean, this is like, this is like political thriller and political espionage level stuff going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's very, very well done. And it's very engaging. You know, when I said that, you know, the narrative structure was a little frustrating. Once it really gets in there, and once you really start putting the pieces together and you see the long con, basically,
right,
it's really well done and it's really engaging. And all credit to Priest, like you said, I mean, he had this planned out. He had this definitely mapped out at least through the first 12 issues. I think the last 5 issues, once it left Marvel Knights, it's a little different.
Well, it becomes more just Marvel.
Yeah.
Some of the greater Marvel universe. But, you know, the Marvel Knights stuff, that's really what we should be focusing on because that's,
right,
you know, that's where it excels. The interesting thing to me is, though, if you've read old Black Panther stories from the 60s, 70s, they always mention the fact that he's king and, you know, Wakanda's a futuristic city. So all those elements are in place, but no one really touched on the fact that he's also a superhero. So what would it be like if your king was also a superhero?
Right.
And what are the implications of that? And Priest really deftly takes all those old, that's what I said in the synopsis. He grabs all these old storylines and instead of just discarding them, Alan Moore style, he, you know, weaves them into his story and addresses them.
And he shows us what has only been suggested in the past.
Exactly. I did like, there's one part where Ross is telling the story of how Black Panther and Captain America met, and it goes back into Kirby style artwork,
which is Amanda Connor.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's really good. And it's Kirby style, and it's a Lee style dialogue and narration. And at one point they have to stop and say, "Why are you talking like that?" It's like, "I don't know, but just go with it."
There's very much a self-awareness.
Yes, but he's acknowledging these things did come before. I'm not just dumping everything and starting over. All this stuff did happen. We're just telling it from a different perspective now.
And again, I can't say enough about the great artwork there that as done by the great Amanda Connor.
Absolutely. There's a lot of really great artists working on this, I think. The art really makes this come alive. I mean, Priest's story and dialogue and narration is really intricate and fun, but at the same time, the art really sells it, whether it's by
Mark Teixeira.
Yeah, and Vince Evans is also one of the artists on here.
Now, see, I uh, I differ a little bit on the art. And maybe it's the format I read it, but particularly to Shara's art, which I have appreciated in other runs and other comics, it's really, really dark. And I don't even mean thematically. I mean, it's just, some of that's the coloring I get. And maybe it's more the color palette than his artwork. But everything is just, it's almost hard to see what's happening. And it was, to me, that was very 90s.
Yes, I agree. But there is, and you talk about the coloring, there are things like that pop, like all the blues have this sort of neon feel to it. And that's the coloring. I'm sorry, I don't have the colorist in front of me. But I found it very unique looking. Yes, it is dark. I do agree with you on that. It is. And it is very 90s. At the same time, I think it just adds, it just gives this feel, because everything's going on at night. Almost the majority of everything is going on at night,
yeah.
With the exception of Bill Clinton beating up Everett Ross every once in a while. And yes, that does happen. Bill Clinton does beat up Everett Ross.
Who was on rollerblades at the time.
Because of course he is. It's the 90s. Everyone was on rollerblades.
Wearing his bike shorts.
But I like it for some reason. It has a really unique feel.
I guess for me, I really felt like I was straining my eyes a little bit. And I think it's when the guest artist took over, and then, you know, it's why like Amanda Connor's, eight page fill or whatever she did just with the Kirby-esque really stood out to me, because it was bright and colorful and defined. Didn't feel quite as muddy. But, you know, I think that when Teixeira left and some of the other artists came in, I felt like some of it cleaned up a little bit. And I was, because I was kind of straining, you know, I was trying to read this on the train, and I was like kind of straining my eyes just to even see what was happening.
I guess I see where you're coming from. I don't know. It just has a really, it just looks neat to me. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, people have different opinions.
No.
Yeah. You don't understand, man. You don't understand greatness.
But, and again, that's like you said, that's just me. That's, you know, that's how I, that was my experience in reading or in visually taking it in, as opposed, you know, the reading part of it was great. It's, you know, that no issue there. Thoroughly enjoyed this series, but the art did cause me some pause a little bit here and there.
Some pause?
Pause. Oh.
Hey, that's awesome. But you clawed your way through, I'm sure. Mm. Okay, so the political intrigue, it all makes sense in the end, but it did get a little bit, it was a little hard to piece together as it was happening, because you had the Wakandan, it's his mother-in-law.
Right.
Right.
Ramonda.
It's T'Challa's mother-in-law, who has allied herself with Akabi.
Right.
Who is a charismatic, crazy man who talks to puppets.
Yeah, and very, very interestingly represented visually as well. But
how far do you want to go into that? Because I had concerns as well. Because he is very, I don't want to say stereotypical, but exaggerated features.
Yes, and I again, this was done on purpose. It was Christopher Priest was doing this on purpose.
Right.
You know, certainly the artist was following Priest's instructions in terms of visual representation. So, I mean, I think Christopher Priest is playing around with a lot of stereotypes in this. I mean, you see it with Ross. You see it with how different individuals react differently to things. You see it in that, you very much see it, and it comes to kind of a very strong fruition in the riot that happens.
Yes.
In New York, which is sort of the close to the end cap of the first 12 issues and sort of where things start to wrap up in terms of that storyline. So, but Akabi is, you know, there's other things. It's the way that Akabi is presented, like very effeminate.
I didn't see him coded as effeminate or gay. That was definitely a thing that was going on in the 90s. So I'm not discounting it.
Right.
I didn't see that. I saw him as flamboyant, but not really effeminate. Rather than effeminate, I would say he's more childlike. Especially with playing with a puppet
We play with the puppet and the dog before that.
Exactly.
But he's also, we also know that he's a stone cold killer from, you know, the supposed origin story that we get of him as Bob, the farmer.
Yes. No, you know what? I do see what you're saying, and that is problematic. And again, that is a representation that was very prevalent in the 90s and in the 80s and in history.
But it's also, you know, to also sort of to take it another direction, let's say, is he is the Joker to Black Panther's Batman.
Yes, yes.
And there is a lot of
good.
There's a lot of Batman analog going on. I mean, a lot of what T'Challa does in the first, say, 12 issues or whatever is detective work. And he does not show all of his cards. And of course, as we find out later, he is aware of much more going on than he lets on.
Right. He does seem, and you know, we find out that this is a strategy of his. He does seem kind of clueless in the beginning, as if he's just kind of being a brute.
Right. And naive.
His way through. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But he's doing a lot of Batman stuff. He's beating up bad guys to get information. He is doing detective work. I mean, I think that's, again, I think this was all intentional. I think it adds to the strength of this story is as part of all of the various sort of subtle things that Priest is doing throughout this whole series.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think he's definitely playing Batman and Joker a little bit with Akabi and T'Challa.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I actually didn't pick up on the Joker thing, but now that you mention it, now that you point that out, it's so obvious. Why didn't I read that? Read it that way. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I did pick up on the, you know, Batman as if, what if Batman were king?
Kind of right.
Yeah, what if Batman, but the ruler of a country? I love that aspect of it, that he is a foreign diplomat on American soil. But he's also an Avenger, and he's also a crime fighter. There's a lot going on. When he goes out to beat someone up, there's a lot of implications to that.
Yeah, and that he has to follow the rules, the U.S. rules, because it's mentioned numerous times about how if this were in Wakanda, most of these folks that he goes after would just be killed.
Yes, the Dora Milaje would have just aced everybody.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he specifically instructs, even though he probably has diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, he's still playing by the rules, though, because he is an Avenger as well, so he needs to be. There is something that I find very interesting about that. His whole relationship with the Avengers, which becomes very complicated during this arc. You know, Ross, of course, calls them all fascists, and they're unregulated,
right?
And they don't answer to anyone. They have no control. No one's controlling them. This was the precursor to Civil War before Mike Miller even dreamed of Civil War. Christopher Priest was playing with those concepts.
Yeah, and this is very prescient in some ways because it's not just Civil War. It's I think some of it reverberates even now in the current Avengers run.
Oh yeah,
if people are reading the current Avengers run where Black Panther has been made. Is this a spoiler alert time? Nah, screw it. Where Black Panther has been made, you know, the chairman or the chairperson of the Avengers, which is creating a lot of problems because since he is not a U.S. citizen, you know, the government, of course, can't control the U.S. government can't claim the Avengers just as their own anymore. And but that Christopher Priest is referring to that type of thing, you know, 30 years before. Being used now.
No, I mean, he's really, I like it when a writer is thinking about things. He's not just, there's a whole bunch of concepts here. And sometimes, especially in superhero comics, they'll just throw out a concept and not think it through. Priest is thinking these things through. What does the head of state of another country who comes to America and acts as a vigilante, what are the implications of that? And it can get nasty in the fact that there's almost a riot that kills a lot of people.
Well, and you know, he essentially declares an act of war on the U.S. based on the U.S.'s involvement, particularly people in power within the United States governmental and business structures. were involved in what is happening in Wakanda and in the usurpation of his power.
Right.
So
I was trying to mention that earlier. The plot of what's going on in Wakanda, the usurpation of the crown in Wakanda, also has ties to Latin American terrorists, the Russian mob, and, you know, rogue factions in the U.S. and the U.S. government.
And big business.
And big business. I mean, it's like Iran-Contra on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just, it's exactly like, you know, Reagan era, well, not just the Reagan era, I mean, we're going way back, you know, the U.S. intervention in South America, you know, via the United Fruit Company. Which has destabilized South America even to this day. So, and that was done purely for, you know, the United Fruit Company's profits. You know, Priest is bringing that idea here into what's being done in Wakanda because they want because the arms manufacturers and the big businesses in the U.S. of course are coveting the vibranium. Of course, we know vibranium is the metal.
It's the very valuable metal, which has an analog to the gold mining in Africa as well. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of levels to this story.
Yeah,
going on. There's a lot of analogs going on,
and all of these are really, I think, expertly handled by Priest.
I agree.
And
I just want to say, thank God that kind of political intrigue and things can't go on today. Thank God that's not going to happen anymore.
Well, we're finally great again, so you're gonna cut that part out, I think.
No. Yeah, I'll cut it out and build a wall around it so that no one But back to the story.
The fictional story.
Yes. And all of that scene, you were mentioning it earlier, that scene of the riot, there's so much going on in that scene. Not just in the political intrigue that we're talking about here, but there's racial issues. In the fact that because the crowd is African-American primarily and
gathering peacefully,
the cops are a little worried about this huge crowd and are just edge.
Are you suggesting the cops might be overreacting?
It's possible that could happen. I know it could never happen in New York.
Right. No.
Yeah.
Especially a Marvel New York where, you know, nothing ever goes wrong.
No, I just, you know, it's mirroring things, real world events, but, you know, amped up to 11.
Right.
But then you have the, so well handled.
Yeah. And the way that Priest shows the slow buildup and shows all of the elements that go into changing a peaceful demonstration into an out and out riot. And all of the machinations that take place behind the scenes or subtly or not so subtly to move the narrative of what's really happening into a different narrative and then having that narrative inform groupthink.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, that was maybe one of the most impressive things to me about this entire series was how Priest move through that entire, it's a couple issues long where all this is going on. I remember reading it. I had to go back and read it twice, like right after I finished, just to wrap my head around like how well he wrote those scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then also interwoven in that are, you know, the Avengers, the big heroes are there, but they're not able to do anything without hurting the crowd.
Right.
You know, they're big, strong people, and like Iron Man has technology, so you can't just fire off your weapons in the middle of a crowd of people.
Right.
So the heroes are stymied. The cops are afraid, and there's all that, and people are fanning their fear, so they're on a hair trigger. Yeah, it just gets more and more and more complicated.
And T'Challa is almost helpless because they want him to speak, you know, and to calm everything down, as it were.
Yeah, but he can't because that could incite people further.
Right.
So he needs to speak to calm them down, but he can't speak because he might make things worse.
Right.
And the wonderful thing is he has Captain America speak. And And I really like the relationship between Captain America and T'Challa in this story, because they're both icons. They're both symbols of their country.
Mm-hmm.
But Cap is just, he's just a hero. He's not a head of state. So, right. So, you know, he's just a symbol. It's a powerful symbol, but he's just a symbol of America. T'Challa actually is the head of state. He actually is the king. So right. there are things again, happen when he does stuff.
Captain America is the Superman to T'Challa's Batman. To go back to that.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. that analog has always been there. And yeah, no, so that's why in this scene when T'Challa says, I'm going to defuse the situation, but you go talk to them. And Cap was like, I what do I say? What do I do? Yeah, I don't know. I there's the way it's portrayed is there's a true friendship and respect there, but at the same time, they can't quite meet as equals.
Right.
If you know what I mean? Because they're in completely different situations.
Right. And they're different cultures, and I don't mean like, you know, racially, I mean just different, literally different countries, different cultural signifiers in their own countries and things like that. So it's
different. You could read it that way, the white and black, but that's not, I don't think that's what's implied here.
Right. Yeah. No, not with Captain America and T'Challa. But it is, you know, it's different worldviews based on different governmental systems, different societal systems, what have you.
And there's different rules for each of them. What Captain America can do is completely different from what T'Challa can do, just by what the government allows them to do. And some of this stuff is said outright, and some of it's just implied, but it's really deftly played.
Yeah. I mean, that 4 or 5 issue sort of bit, and it's sort of right there in the middle of the 17 issues that we read for this, remains my favorite.
Yeah, it's kind of the first two arcs. It's the first 12 issues, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, it's the client, you know, when we first get introduced to what Ross is doing and what the situation is. And then the second arc dealing with the political problems in Wakanda.
Right.
That's it. That's all we really need. The other stuff, the issues that come after that are good and they're still really, really entertaining. Don't get me wrong. But that first chunk, those first 12 issues are just classic. There are things like, you know, some references don't age well.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of music and film references.
Yeah, at one point,
mostly made by Ross.
Yeah, at one point Ross says, "I feel like I'm in a Van Damme film." It's like, ooh, that's an old one.
Yeah, which roots it a little strongly in the time of the writing, but
I understand that. I mean, you want to make things when you're releasing it, you want it to be of the time,
right?
You know, because, you know, I read 70s comics and they're always making references to the Carpenters and, you know, and I just watched All in the Family last night. Like, yeah, that's really old. But
that's also a very Marvel thing, too. DC did it, but not to the extent like you read those Marvel comics and they like from the 70s and 80s. They very much root themselves. They very much have, you know, to the point where the Avengers appeared on David Letterman. You know?
Well, yeah, exactly. And every time there's a president, it's the real president.
Right.
Yeah, to the point where Bill Clinton's in this. I think it was pre-Lewinsky scandal, because none of that's mentioned, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I think it is.
So other than that, I mean, yes, there are some references at the time that don't particularly age well, but overall the story is fantastic.
And I think, you know, we would be remiss that we can't talk about every character or whatever, but I think we should note what a great supporting cast of characters there are in this comic as well, from Zuri and, you know, the Dora Milaje, both Nakia and Okoye, who obviously one develop some problems later on in the series. Yes. Detective Torque, you know, you know, we have the White Wolf, who is also a very intriguing character, him being the head of the Hatute Zaruze, or I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but basically the secret police, the Wakandan secret police. Right. And he has a really interesting story.
Well, and a lot of these characters are just reimagined. You know, because the White Wolf was, you know, a character from the earlier runs.
Right.
And was just your standard bog villain. But this right. is so different. There's so much complexity and intrigue going on. It's really, I can't praise Priest enough on this. And yeah, nowadays when I look at Black Panther and a Black Panther comic, the Dora Milaje, I just think have been around forever. You know, to know that, no, they were just created for this comic. I mean, they become incredibly popular and part of the lore.
For sure.
But they were just introduced in this run, which was amazing to me.
And see, I did not know that.
Yeah. I said for sure they must have come out, at least in McGregor, if not Kirby. So it's pretty impressive, I thought. That's a good addition to the legend of the Black Panther.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, we can't really talk about each of these characters' individual arcs or their development throughout it, but, you know, I recommend reading this, so, you know, you're doing yourself a favor by being able to experience without us telling you necessarily, but you're able to see these characters develop with your own reading and your own eyes. And, you know, there's, like, I love Detective Torque. I have no idea, like, what his deal is, but he's great.
But, yeah, really adept at characterization and just setting it up. And giant robotic panthers.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, you got to love.
Which was very transformed. Like, I saw that, and it was like, oh, Transformers.
Yeah, I know. I remember reading that and just kind of like, oh, wow, so we're going there. Eat.
Well, and not just the gigantic, you know, robotic panthers, but the giant, the toy machine where you get the claw machine.
Because it's so rooted in reality. And then suddenly it's like, boom, we're full on comics right now.
Right. Then you've got like the Black Panther and Everett Ross in this giant, you know, toy claw machine. Yeah. Like, where did that come from? Is that like, not to go back again, but did that come from like 1940s Batman? Did the Joker invent this?
Yes, like, the toy maker.
Yeah, the toy maker. When did Ackabee have time to construct this thing?
You know, he had a lot of time on his hands.
Like, who did he get to make this? And do the people making this kind of go, what is this? What are we making this for?
Exactly. I'd love to see the plans come across the, you know, the engineer's desk. Right. Seriously? Giant claw machine, huh? All right.
And if we're following the timeline, they had about 2 weeks to make it.
Well, Wakanda is a very futuristic society. So
true.
I don't put it past them. They could probably do a claw machine and giant panthers.
Well, they are the most technically advanced nation on the planet, so. Yeah. If any country can do it, it's Wakanda.
Absolutely. Make Wakanda great again.
Ooh. Ooh.
But this is a... I personally love this run. I think it's really good comics.
Yeah.
I don't know how... You know, I don't know how far we want to go with it, because what you just said is perfect, is you could hear us ramble on about various elements of the story, but you got to read it.
Right.
If nothing, just to see, like, I love the fact that Ross always just drops, and then it got bad, and then it got worse.
Oh, and you know, we haven't even mentioned, you know, you've got the great, like, chapter headings.
Yes.
Some of which are puns, which I know you're probably enjoyed. Some of them are very referential, but.
I do like a good pun every now and again. Yeah. This is really well done, and. It's one of those, I think this is one of those transitional comics that, you know, you see a different type of storytelling and a different way of looking at how comics are presented and what themes they're going to use. You know, a lot of the things that he touches on in these comics are things that writers use all the time now.
Yeah.
But when he was writing this, it was, you know, in the early, late 90s, this was revolutionary.
Yeah, there wasn't, you know, the 90s are always going to be difficult. This isn't the first time we've said that. This won't be the last time we refer to the difficulty of the 90s in comics. But, I mean, I think there were other writers and there were other series out there that were doing similar things, but we were still in the overly spandexed, simplistic plots with a lot of punching, and there's a lot of punching in this comic.
Oh, there are, but it's still
talk about like the themes and what there's whole issues that are pretty much nonstop action.
But it's usually done with
That's not a bad thing.
No, there's a few.
Part of why we read some of these comics is, you know, superhero fights and action and what have you.
Yeah, but there's a few issues where there are a lot of fighting and a lot of running over rooftops, but it also has that 70s style of explaining things as you go. So right. It's sort of like punching exposition.
Punching exposition.
Yes. I'm going to punch you, but I'm going to tell you exactly what's going on.
If that's not a phrase if that doesn't exist yet, that should be a thing. Punching exposition. I plan on using that in the future.
Well, I love it. I mean, the 70s use that stuff all the time addition to, these are my superpowers and I'm going to use them and tell you exactly how I'm going to use them as I'm using them.
But back then, of course, it was all done in Thought Balloon.
Exactly. Yeah.
At some point they got rid of the thought balloons, which, you know, and then now it's all just done in letterboxing. And I miss the thought balloon a little bit.
I miss the thought balloon a lot, but I think we digress.
Who, us?
Yes. Shockingly enough, we digress.
Surely you're joking.
Digression is the better part of valor. Don't call me Shirley. So I think that's it. I highly recommend anyone who hasn't read this series, go and get the Marvel Knights run by Christopher Priest of Black Panther and just enjoy the wonderfulness of it.
I concur.
Okay. So that's it for that this time. Hey, you know, it just occurred to me, I don't think we do this on purpose, but we tend to always recommend stuff in one era. Like we'll do the 70s for a little while, then the 80s for a little while. Now we're on the 90s. Because my last
recommendation was
90s.
Yeah.
Sandman.
Well, that's why I try to go back to, you know, and do stuff like, Donald, the Uncle Scrooge, you know, and just, or the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, you've gone way back.
At some point, we're going to have to do the Spirit, although there's going to be some caveats on that as well. But
well, anything Golden Age is going to be definitely caveats. I'd like to do some Captain America, but from back then, but there's some questionable stuff in there too. Neither here nor there. Brian, you probably have a recommendation for next time.
I do indeed have a recommendation for next time, and it won't be from the 90s.
Excellent.
It'll be from the 80s. So for our next podcast and reading enjoyment and discussion group, book club, I am going to recommend J.M. DeMatteis, Keith Giffen's, and Kevin McGuire's lovely, wonderful, seminal run on Justice League International.
And
so we're going to start at the beginning of their run. There's really not a good arc to say this is the one. And it's also a little tricky because it started off as Justice League, then changed its name to Justice League International, then changed its name to Justice League America, then there was Justice League Europe, and things got kind of complicated, and, you know, we think comics now are bad with renumbering and rebooting. It was happening back then as well. So we're essentially going to read the first 13 issues of DeMatteis, Giffen's, and McGuire's Justice League International, which the first 7 issues, I think, were Justice League. And then for issues 8 through we're going to go up through 13 issues, 8 through 13, then were under the banner Justice League International.
Excellent. So I look forward to revisiting that glorious bit of fantasticness.
Hopefully I didn't make it too complicated with the Justice League International issues 1 through 13.
Boom. Done. Yeah. And that is the run from 1987.
Yeah, starting in 87, I think, is when it started.
So, I think that's it for this episode of the Fabulous Collected Edition. Anything else you want to say?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Please send us your comments to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. Visit our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or hit us up on Twitter, collectededpod, that's collectededpod, or you can use, you could send us a message in a bottle, and next time I'm at the beach, I'll find it. You know, might be a long response time, though. I don't know what I'm talking about. I think that's it, everybody. So carrier thanks pigeon. Again for Carrier Pigeon's good, Semaphore Flag, anything.
Pony Express.
Skywriting.
Ooh, skywriting. Yes. I think the skywriting was where we want to go.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at collectededpod, that's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?